Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams, keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hello, Santa Barbara. Welcome to another edition of Community Alert, Not If, But When. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Ted Adams still in the European theater, stomping around Paris someplace. I'm not sure where. He's going to be gone for another 2 weeks, but he'll be joining us shortly. Got a great show today. We're going to be talking about health care and a doctor's declaration of independence here in just a minute, but a couple of announcements here. First of all, prevent accidental wildfires. Maintain vehicle brakes. Never let brake pads wear thin and become hot, and where hot and metal will be discharging out onto the street. And this is a major cause of wildfires up along the freeways. When you're driving down the freeway and you see little fires along the side of the road, brake and catalytic converters are some of the major causes, along with dragging chains. So if you have chains on your vehicle, make sure they're not dragging along the ground. For this and other wildfire prevention techniques, visit Santa Barbara County Fire Department, sbcfire.com. That's sbcfire.com. Defensible space inspections, ready, set, go. That also available at the fire department website of your choice. All of them here in Santa Barbara participating. sbcfire.com, the quickest and easiest to get that information. And, of course, today is Tuesday, get out and vote day. I don't know if everybody's voted yet, but this is the day to go do it. We have several critical elections going here locally, Measure M, Sheriff, and a couple of council seats. So get out there and get your vote today. A couple months ago, I was in, well, it wasn't that far along. It was April 28th. A Doctor's Declaration of Independence was on the cover of the Wall Street Journal I stumbled into. And this article caught my attention. I read it twice, and I said, I got to talk to this guy. And I have him here in the studio today. Dr. Graviato, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What inspired you to write this? Before we get into the nuts and bolts, this was a big thing for you.
It was, and I've never done anything like this before. So I think what inspired me to write this editorial is that kind of a sense of frustration in how we as physicians are impacted by some of the mandates and some of the rules that come out of Washington, D.C., and this source of frustration of how maybe non-medical people in our country are making decisions that impact healthcare, and that I, as an individual physician in the trenches, was living with this. And so that source of frustration as an individual physician in the trenches is what really led me to write this editorial and submit it.
And it suddenly became international. That must have caught you by surprise.
It did catch me by surprise.
Because I was reading this, and I go, God, who is this guy? Where am I going to have to call to track him down? It said Santa Barbara, California. And I said, you got to be kidding me. He's in Goleta.
Well, you know what? That's what I said, too. When they decided to publish it, and then seeing the response that it gained from the emails and the phone calls and the letters that were sent to me, I thought I had hit a chord, but I didn't quite know until I really saw the response that came in.
Mm-hmm. Well, for those that haven't seen this, and I imagine that's most of our listeners, go to Dr. Google and type in a Doctor's Declaration of Independence. You could probably use the name Graviotto Jr., and you should get a hit on the Wall Street Journal. And it's a great, great opinion piece. It's fabulous. And it doesn't draw any conclusions or throw any rocks at any one person. It's right up the middle. This is it.
That's correct. I tried to write this as apolitical as possible. And my whole focus was to write it as a physician, like I stated earlier, who does this every day, to communicate to the public and our patients what we as physicians are really feeling, how this is impacting us individually and as a group of physicians collectively across the country as healthcare changes.
Well, let's back up just a little bit. What type of medicine do you practice and how long have you been independent?
I'm an orthopedic surgeon, born and raised here in Santa Barbara. I finished my orthopedic residency in 1991. I spent 3 years in San Diego and then in 1994 moved back to Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm. So you've been in private practice the rest of the time?
I have.
And you with your colleagues, how are you feeling about what's happening today as you work with your patients? The frustration level from everybody is running at 100%. Everybody is trying to cast dispersions to somebody else. I don't think anybody's really looking down the road to see what the real issues are.
It's frustrating, there's no doubt, and that's probably an understatement. One of the things I've said is that, you know, I can't, and I wouldn't obviously try to speak for all physicians. That's a big group of people, and there are individuals and probably a difference of opinion amongst us. But I think for the most part, this particular thing that I tried to address is probably shared by most, if not all, physicians, this frustration of how our world as physicians and the doctor-patient relationship, how that is being impacted by some of these changes in mandates in healthcare.
Mm-hmm. So what are you seeing as the major issues that are impacting physicians such as yourself that are independent, that are working in small offices? Because you're also small businesses, just like my small business and others. Well, you've got that to factor in there, too. What are the big-ticket issues that are confronting you today?
Well, based on some of the changes that have occurred and what we have to do to satisfy some government regulations, such as electronic health records and some of the things we now have to document in the electronic health record, time management is a big thing. So this has increased the amount of time we have to spend to be able to do this extra level of documentation. So for me, individually, when I first converted to an electronic health record, and let me say, no one is talking about going back to the days of paper. I think those days are gone. So
for sure.
Some of this probably is and might just be some growing pains we have to go through. But when I first started doing this electronic health record, it probably increased the amount of time I spend per patient by 8 to 10 minutes. I probably have that down now to about 5 minutes. So if I see 20 patients in a four-hour period of time, like in the afternoon, add it up, that's another 100 minutes of time I have to spend. And the concern is if I'm spending more time doing data entry and medical documentation, well, then the obvious result of that is there's less time to see patients.
Now, this documentation is in what form? I mean, what type of additional stuff? Certainly billing codes and insurance codes are a big part of it.
There's that. But one of the things that the government stipulated, and this was in, it came out of the Stimulus Act of all things in 2009, something called the HITECH Act. And Congress appropriated $155 billion towards healthcare, of which $26 billion was directed towards the Department of Health and Human Services to promote and expand the adoption of health information technology in the electronic health record. Some of the things I now do that I didn't do before is every patient that comes in, even to the orthopedic surgeon's office, has to have a blood pressure recorded and their pulse taken and their height and weight. Well, you could question, well, does the orthopedic surgeon really have to do that on every patient? So some of these new things that we have to do that we weren't doing before, and all of that, all of it is data entry, and all of it takes extra time.
Well, it's obviously time-consuming, and I have a friend that's in, just got out of a rehabilitation center who had a serious foot infection through diabetes, got up into his bone marrow and stuff, and I watched them treat his wound, and it was fascinating. They came in and photographed it, then they unwrapped it, they photographed it again, they treated it, gauzed it, put it back together, and then photographed it yet again, all the while making multiple trips to the computer that's bolted to the crash cart, making data entries. All the while, there's another nurse or RN, whatever she was, coming in with a barcode reader every 15 minutes and scanning the barcode. So they've got somebody that actually walks around and makes sure the patients are still in the same beds they were in 15 minutes ago. And I'm thinking, you know, I understand from a risk management point of view and probably prior civil cases that have happened throughout the country why they do this, but I'm thinking it's taking an exorbitant amount of time. When's the patient ever get any rest? And how much of this really is necessary? It seems like it's an extension of what you're talking about.
It is. And the challenge for physicians within the last 2 or 3 years since all of this became law is this is a technology, right? It's mm-hmm. the use of computers so that the patient comes in the room. And how do I maintain the doctor-patient relationship and what I have to do from a clinical standpoint but then interface this new tool, this computer in the room, without taking away from my time interacting with the patient. I hear complaints all the time from patients who will tell me, you know, I've been to other doctors and they stare into the computer screen and they're not looking at me because they're checking on boxes. And it's a real problem. It's a struggle. How do you use this new technology and yet not lose all of the kind of the art part of medicine or healthcare, looking into the patient's eyes, you know, examining the patient, listening to the story they have to tell, when you have this new thing in the room called the computer? And so that's a challenge, and every physician will do it a little bit differently. But it has made a definite impact in terms of, and change in terms of, what happens in the examination room now that all of this has changed.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a minute up on our first break. Talking today about a doctor's declaration of independence on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. Live on the internet at newspress.com on KCSB AM 1290 or Santa Barbara News Press Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Community Alert, Not It But When. Ted Adams in Paris, gallivanting around with his daughter, having a great time. I wish I was there with him. Probably wouldn't come home. Talking today about a doctor's declaration of independence. Let's go through what a traditional physician's life is like today as far as your schedule goes, because it's not Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, punch the clock, hour for lunch, like some people may think it is. What is your day like?
So I will speak from my reference point as an orthopedic surgeon, which is one type of physician, but typically I will get up at 5:30 in the morning, get into the office at about 6:15, 6:30. There's usually some paperwork for me to do. I typically start the day at 7:15 with a surgery, a knee replacement or a hip replacement, and I'll do one or two of those in the morning. And then there are patients after those patients. So we operate, finish the operation, write physician orders on that patient for their surgery, do two of those. Then I usually have other patients in the hospital that I had done surgery on the previous days. I then make my hospital rounds and see those patients. Then after that, in the afternoon, I'll have my clinic where I see patients in the office. On average, I probably see 20 to 24 patients in the afternoon. And then I'm usually, we say we're going to end at 5, but realistically, and especially in the world of orthopedics, there are add-ons and emergencies. I usually wrap it up by 5:30 or 6, go home, have dinner with the family, which is our family time around the dinner table. And then usually, because of what I was speaking to earlier, this increased workload now with the electronic health record, I usually then have another hour to hour and a half of dictation, medical chart dictation to do in the electronic health record. So, and when you asked earlier what has really caused this frustration, that's what it is more than anything, because of this increased time of what I have to do for documentation. I now am spending an hour and a half or an hour at home after dinner doing all this just to stay caught up, to prevent an audit, to stay, you know, as precise as I can. But that's pretty much my typical day.
And that's 5-6 days a week.
That is 5 days a week, certainly. And then I'm on call for the emergency room. So I'm on call every Tuesday at Goleta Valley Cottage Hospital, every Tuesday of each week. And then I'm on call in the emergency room 1 weekend a month. So when you're on call, you are going to get patients through the emergency room, either a hip fracture, a trauma, some type of orthopedic injury or illness that you will be called from the emergency room to go in and dress. Those are usually nighttime hours or weekend hours.
So it becomes all-encompassing. It becomes your life for practical purposes.
It becomes your life. I mean, you try to build in some things where you can maintain some time to yourself. So you share a call with other physicians. You try to limit your office hours as much as you can. But it's time-consuming.
Now, we see a potential shortage of physicians coming. In fact, there was an article in just today, which one was this one in, Healthcare Magazine just came out with this. Doctor shortages aren't just the Veterans Affairs problems, they are a nationwide problem. This just came out today, and we certainly know this to be true. The new crop of physicians that are coming into the business today, or that are maybe even still in residency or still in school, are they ready to take all of this on? Because it's kind of contrary to the way most people live their lives today.
I don't think anyone is ready or knows what it fully is once you leave your training period, right? You don't know what the real world entails. You think you do, but not really till you're in it. You know, do you really know? And one of the things that's changed, I think there will always be people who want to go into medicine and be physicians. And don't get me wrong, it's a very rewarding career. I love what I do as an orthopedic surgeon. But there will be physicians who always want to do that. But it's changing a little bit. These physicians coming out now are going to be in a lot of debt, $200,000-$300,000, maybe more in debt. It's going to be hard for them to pay off their loans. They're used to a certain work schedule in their residency nows. They are mandated, or there's laws now that they can only work so many hours. So they're used to that, working only so many hours. So I think the tendency is, and I know this is true, this is a new trend developing. The newer physicians coming out, a lot of them, if not most, just want to end up working for a, and there's nothing wrong with that, for a multi-specialty clinic or a hospital. They are salaried individuals because they do not want to deal with some of the hassles and the inconveniences and the challenges of setting up and starting your own practice and being a business person in that practice.
Which in and of itself is its own skills.
It's another set of skills that no one really teaches you in your residency training program.
And I suspect, well, I have a friend of mine I grew up with. We both wanted to be physicians, truth be known. His dad was an anesthesiologist down in Orange County, very prominent fellow. He died 3 days after he talked us out of going into medicine. And as a result, Marty decided to become a physician. And he took it the ultra hard route to do it because we both had several problems going for us. Poor grades, need for money, you know, no financial support to speak of. I mean, all of the obstacles that you would have in any career, but medicine in particular is so blasted demanding because you're looking at a 12 to 15 year commitment, depending on what you're trying to do. Well, he went on and he graduated from medical school, did his internship in the European world, and ends up at faculty at UC San Francisco and ironically works for the Veterans Administration. But it was a long, tedious road. Now, he loves it. But in talking to him, he said that was one of the challenges that he had is all of a sudden you got to practice, you hang your shield, but nobody told us how to set up an office. I mean, some of it's intuitive, but you got to have desk, you got to have office supplies, you got to have a secretary who's going to answer the phone, who's going to do the billing, what about taxes and payroll? And it just becomes daunting, and it just wakes folks up.
Yeah, it certainly does. And besides all the things I mentioned that I did earlier, I didn't even mention that one, right?
Right.
So it's just another layer of more work. So
I think it's a trend. I read an article just this morning, getting prepped up for today, about airline pilots spending anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000 to get the kind of training and schooling and education that you need now to be able to compete to get a job as a commercial airline. But I'm talking about the airlines. And how are you going to pay that off? And they're talking about how many of these pilots get jobs in commuters and small-end airlines, and they're ending up on food stamps because they can't afford to live. And yet they're working these incredible hours. And as it related to medicine, back when I was on the job, I remember being in the emergency rooms countless times, UCLA in particular. These doctors are up 2-3 days in a row. There are interns there, and they don't see that so much today. But these guys were working incredible hours in what basically was a sub-county hospital, because what was not going straight to USC was coming into places like Harbor General and UCLA and St. John's over in Santa Monica and then transferred. I think the job in the emergency room certainly has changed a little bit. But when I look at the documentation requirements that you're talking about, I'm thinking, well, who's doing all the work? I mean, certainly the physicians and the nurses aren't. The emergency room's so dynamic in what's going on in there. And then I run into these folks having lunch the other day at Cottage Hospital called scribes. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about how the industry's trying to adapt a little bit to doing some of the work that you're talking about. But there's got to be a cost associated with that. So with that, we'll be back in just a minute on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster, live on the internet at newspress.com on KZSB AM 1290. Welcome back to Community Alert. Talking today about a doctor's declaration of independence that made the Wall Street Journal. Again, the date on that article was, where is it here? April 28, 2014, Wall Street Journal. Go to Dr. Google, type that in, a doctor's declaration of independence, and I think you'll hit it. It's a fascinating read, and it came from right here in Goleta, California, of all places. We were talking during the break about some of the frustrations of how we got to where we are, and I'm talking about us as everybody, not just physicians, not just hospitals and insurers. Everybody needs physicians in a hospital sooner or later. We all more or less started in a hospital. Why is the big frustration? Why isn't the medical community, the physicians themselves and the nurses and the people that actually are touching people and making them well, why aren't they involved in the equations that are getting these policies set? They've been discharged.
Well, we should be. I think there are many factors for that. One, physicians as a group are working so hard just on our own, like I just outlined. We're all so busy. Who has time to enter the, you know, public policy debate? Who has time to go to Washington? I mean, we're so busy doing this, and we don't speak with one voice. We are not harnessing the power of physicians as a group to be able to stand up and say, you know, enough is enough. So our societies try to do that when they go to Washington, but I think they try to do the best they can, but they can only be so effective. And so no one has really stood up and is really trying to change it. It's almost absurd to me that you are forming healthcare policy and really not involving the physicians, the one who direct healthcare. You're not involving them to say, hey, what's bad with the system and what's good with the system. I don't understand how you can run a significant portion of this country in terms of GDP without getting involved the people who are at their very nature are the ones who write the orders for medications and diagnostic tests and surgery. So I think that's a challenge for the United States, you know, how we go forward. And thus far, for the most part, we're kind of shut out of the room.
Which strikes me as really curious because it's the physicians are the smart guys. I mean, they're the ones that actually went to school and learned how to do all this stuff. And the fact that nobody wants to listen to them on a large scale to find out what the real problems are going on Hollister Avenue and all those medical clinics over there or over there in Pueblo and Bath, they don't want to hear about all of that. They want to see how it looks on their balance sheets or in their research study or the stats that they're collecting on a national or regional level. That's what they want to look at. And I'm not sure that really addresses the hardcore reality of what it's like to be with the patients at the time that things are actually happening. It becomes too sterile.
It does. And so I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I am not a healthcare policy expert. I'm not an expert in healthcare economics, but as in many things in our society, that oftentimes those people, whether they're in Washington or elsewhere, that are making policy decisions, they're so removed from the physician's office and exam room that they lose sight maybe of some of the implications, some of the consequences of the decisions they think when they're making good decisions, they don't get to see the net effect. Mm-hmm. And that editorial was written by one physician, one small doctor in one small town, Santa Barbara, California, speaking out to let people know, wake up, because healthcare is changing. And realize that if I read my colleagues right, which I think I do, physicians, for the most part, are tired. We're tired of all of this.
Well, and if the physicians are getting tired, who's going to come in behind them? I know up in Trinity County, for example, the hospital has a terrible time even staying open, much less staffed. And the closest medical facility you can get to up there is in Redding, which under the most ideal circumstances is an hour away at best, and that's through narrow, windy roads. They're certainly not the only county that's having that. These physicians that operate in the rural parts of the country have it even worse because they don't have any of the financial support. They don't have the volume of patients, and they don't necessarily have the state-of-the-art technology either. And yet we're talking about our families. We're talking about our grandparents. We're talking about the people we work with. We're talking about people we went to school with and what have you. I think that they've been pretty successful in dehumanizing the very thing that's supposed to be at the core of our soul, I should think. And it's very frustrating. That's why I've taken an interest in it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's part of it, and that's part of the frustration. And just to see how that kind of the doctor-patient relationship has changed because of all these changes. And again, no one is saying go back to paper.
No, I don't think so.
There's so many things. Healthcare is so complex. And I don't know. That's one of the challenges. I'm not sure what the answers are. I'm just speaking out as one physician.
Well, I think that we don't know what the answers are. I agree with you. The question then becomes, why aren't we talking to the people that would be best equipped for obtaining those answers? I mean, medicine's science. I mean, it's based on fact. It's a collection of data, analyzing the data, and coming up with factual information. It seems to me that that may be something they don't want to deal with is facts. They're looking more at other issues, whatever they may be, perhaps legitimate also. Like, who's going to pay? Which it really gets down to the bottom line, who's going to pay for all of this? We got more patients than we have physicians. We have more patients than we have places to put them. We don't have enough clinics. How are we going to make this all work? It's going to be a challenge.
It is a challenge, and I think what is frustrating for those on the outside, those responsible to make healthcare policy decisions in this country, is that they don't understand medicine. They're baffled by it. They don't come from that discipline, from our discipline. So, you know, a lot of healthcare, there's not always a black and white answer. There's some gray areas, right? But the people who want to make policy think that, oh, if we only had an algorithm, surely we can come up with an algorithm to direct the perfect treatment for someone who walks in with chest pain or the perfect ideal treatment for someone who walks in with knee pain. They're thinking in those terms, and, you know, it's not this nice, neat, packaged bundle. The human body is complex, and you can't tailor it like that. It just won't work.
I look at the process of medicine and people coming in and out, and I kind of look at it, and I say, you know, it's a lot of similarities to a body shop dealing with cars that get damaged on the freeways, and they come in and the adjuster comes out and they look at it, they go to their computer and they figure out make, model, year, and they determine whether or not your car's worth fixing. And if it is worth fixing, they can tell you almost down to the cent what it's going to cost for the parts and what have you. And you just can tell by looking at the guy that's going to actually physically do the work, he's just shaking his head because he knows that you need one of these or you don't need one of those, or you don't buy this kit, you want to buy that kit. And I mean, it's all the variables, but they're not allowed to work their trade, and fixing cars is an art of its own right. How much has medicine become like that?
What is like that? I was going to read you this. I received a lot of letters from
I bet you did.
Patients, and I won't go into the whole letter, but this, it was interesting just speaking to that. This husband and wife, their patients wrote me this letter, and they were going on about, they know all too well some of the bureaucracy because they were both in the military for 20 years, so they were speaking to military medicine. But I love his last line, and because he's speaking to how there's mandates towards physicians. But his last line, he stated this: mechanics are permitted more autonomy in troubleshooting and repairing machinery than physicians are with taking care of human lives.
That's amazing, isn't
it? So imagine that. You know, mechanics, that's the way physicians used to be. Give us some freedom. And we still have some of that. I'm not saying it's all or none. But the more, you know, the more mandates there are, the more bureaucracy that comes out. And I understand the need for some of it. It just becomes more and more difficult.
I think medicine's one of those occupations where experience means everything. Because you're going to see something that a new guy may not see, or a nurse wouldn't see, or a PA might not see, because of experience and level of training and education and background and having kept up on something that was a similar case that happened somewhere else. And you go, well, don't do that on this case. And that requires interaction. That requires hands-on. That requires communication. It's how do you know the difference between temperature and a sore throat from just being the flu and being meningitis or something? I mean, it's just it's experience. It's looking in their eyes. It's seeing the pain. It's what questions you ask. It's being deprived in some degree, I think, in your ability to function that way.
It is. I think when you take a certain amount of autonomy away, or when the physician in the room is so concerned about justification and medical documentation in the chart, do you lose focus a little bit? Sure you do. It's human nature.
Yeah.
right? So, to take away the autonomy where it's going that way, I think, a little bit, that's kind of a frightening thing.
Well, jumping real fast, I guess, almost to whiplash speed, what if the physicians just said, we're not going to do this anymore. You want my services? I'm happy to give them to you, but you bring your checkbook with you. And we just change the dynamics of the whole process. The physicians would have control over that. We'll come back and answer that question after these messages on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster, live on KZSB AM 1290. Welcome back to Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. Doctor's Declaration of Independence, today's discussion. We were talking about what if the physicians as a group said, forget it, we're not going to do the insurance game anymore. You guys can have it all you want, have at it. We're cash and carry. What if they did and went back to a traditional business model? What would happen?
Well, I think a lot would happen. First of all, I think if that were to happen, a lot of people would stand up and take notice. If there were a significant portion of physicians who said, we are no longer going to take Medicare, immediately I think the elderly patients would go to their local representative and ask the question, well, what happened? What did you do to the physicians that they're so upset they're not taking Medicare anymore? So that one thing in and of itself, if it would happen, would almost change the equation immediately, would almost force those making healthcare policy decisions to come back to us and say, how can we include you? What is wrong? Why did you step away from this? I'm not sure if that'll ever happen because I think as physicians, it is in our very DNA to do the responsible thing and to take care of patients.
It's why you're there.
It's why we're there. We went through college and medical school, trying to do the next test, taking the next thing, and then residency, taking care of patients. So, yeah, in general, we are not that type of individual where we're good. But I think there might be now these different forces that are coming together that could change that. And that's the question: what's going to happen in the next 5 years? And with healthcare in this country?
Well, I look at a doctor's office as being like any other office. You've got the same overhead that a lawyer would have or an insurance broker or anybody running real estate, whatever your office is, the overhead's more or less the same. And you have an accountant, you have a tax person, and both of them are going to be telling you the same thing that they would be telling any other small business. Eventually, it becomes too expensive to be in business. And physicians can't afford to be a charity. And in turn, the new guys coming into the business have got loans to pay off. So they've got financial commitments that probably exceed what the people that are in our age bracket are in. And they're going to say, well, how can I make any money? I got to make enough money to at least survive. I didn't go to medical school to be working for minimum wage or to be a slave to a bunch of banks. So I see this as becoming kind of a numbers game, even for the physicians, just within their level. And the patient's sitting here out in the lobby trying to get treated for whatever it is their ailment is, while the industry itself is in great flux and turmoil and trying to figure out who that's going to get paid and how do they protect their interest of their little domain. There's going to be a battle of sorts.
Yeah, I think you're right on a lot of those things you just mentioned. I'll say as an orthopedic surgeon, I'm very blessed to be able to do what I do. I love what I do, and not everyone can say that. I love what I do. So hear me. And I make a good living. I'm not complaining about that.
No, I understand.
But the trend line is such. So one of the things I mentioned in my editorial, if you look at the reimbursement price for total knee replacement surgery from about 1992 to 2010, in real dollars, based on 1992 dollars, it decreased 68%, while the cost of living was going up about 2 to 3% a year. So again, I'm not saying that I don't make a good living or that physicians aren't reimbursed appropriately. We are. But if those trend lines continue, you're exactly right. If reimbursements keep dropping for physicians and costs keep going up, at some point, you're going to have a crisis.
Well, and we were talking during the break, and I can I deal a lot in my real world with process, filling out forms, making sure they're correct, and then getting them kicked back and changing this. If you had that with every single patient, or even every other patient, or every third patient, you'd be crippled in process alone. And so it's the bureaucracy and the process of getting paid or transmitting or making referrals to other facilities or admitting or whatever it may be, even all the way down to the pharmacist level. And I notice a lot of changes going on in the pharmacy world just by, as a consumer. And most of it seems to be risk management oriented and just ultra documentation and verification, which I mean, I understand why they got to do it. But then I'm thinking, why do we have to do this? I mean, where does common sense suddenly get dismissed?
And the question is, the premise is that doing some of these things, these new mandates or the regulations, that they're going to improve quality. Well, that sounds good. I'm not convinced that all of a sudden, because the orthopedic surgeon is cranking out a computer-generated 6-page medical report, that that's any better or more quality than a succinct 1-page medical report. Why do we do that? Because we're concerned now with all these rules and regulations that, boy, if I'm lacking in any way and someone audits me, and I, even if it's by accident, said, well, this was the level of the visit, that's what you were reimbursed, but my medical documentation doesn't justify that, that's a huge fine. And so, I don't know, we're creating a whole bunch of extra work, and I'm not convinced it's going to improve quality.
Well, who's measuring what the definition of quality is? I mean, the patients who come in with pain, their hips, their knees, their feet, or whatever, and how many of those folks are restored to normal lifestyles versus those who are not? Is that the standard of quality, or is it based on your performance in the paper room?
Well, that's, I mean, ask a great question, right? So the people who are looking at the upper levels are looking at, right, just general graphs and charts and things. But it might be different if you were to look at patient outcomes or what the patient says, how they're doing.
Well, it was my discovery when I was doing all the research with EMS. I had, as a cop, always thought that it was a success when we brought somebody through the back door and they were breathing. We saved their life. We got them to the hospital in one piece. Well, that's not the way the medical community views a save. That's a save 30 days after they're discharged from the hospital. Whoa, I say to myself, that's a huge difference. How many people did we bring in that never got to walk out the front door? They did, but died at home, and they're at home. And that's a pretty significant number when you do the research. A lot of people don't make it. And I'm thinking, wow, that's not a save after all. Now, that's not to say anybody should change their tactics or what they do in the process, but it really woke me up. And I see the same issue coming up with you. If we're going to define what winning is, or we're going to define what quality is, as something other than my tooth doesn't hurt anymore or my hip doesn't work anymore, if that's not going to be our measure, then we got a situation that's going to be problematic.
That's correct. And what you just suggested, it all depends on what you're defining and what you're trying to qualify and what the parameter is, right? Numbers can look differently depending on how you look at it. And the real concern is we have these people at upper levels now that are non-medical people making decisions about what that looks like and what they think is the best parameter or the best event or the best whatever to choose to measure those things.
If you could do whatever you wanted for the medical community, what would be the things that you would do to change the system so that it would be more functional? I know it's a huge question. But
yeah, on many different issues, right? I think the one thing that would be a big change, and it's right now we currently can't do it, is if physicians had collective bargaining rights where we as a group mm-hmm. could push back a little bit against some of the third-party payers or insurance companies or even Medicare to say that as a group, we don't think this is right. As a group, we are not going to sign that contract. That would empower physicians, right? That would give us a little more. And it's not just reimbursement I'm speaking to. It's a whole host of other issues. But we don't have those rights. And as a group, we're kind of separated out. We don't mm-hmm. have a one body kind of with a sense of empowerment that we can make those changes.
It gives the appearance of a divide and conquer. The guys will do whatever we want because they got their loans to pay and their lifestyle and their practice.
And we know they're busy.
Yeah.
And they're just going to sign the contract because we know it's a significant portion of their patient population base.
Yeah.
So, but for stepping away and not signing the contract and not taking insurance, there's not a whole lot we can do.
Sure, sure. And maybe it's the patients that need to stand up. Millions upon millions, because we're all potential patients. With that, we're up to our next break. Talking about a doctor's declaration of independence on Community Alert. Not If But When, positive preparation for disaster. Ted Adams not worrying about any of this stuff as he's dining on some cafe in Paris someplace. On KZSB, AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Community Alert. Talking today with Dr. Craviotto on a doctor's declaration of independence. We're in our last segment, Doctor. What closing thoughts do you have on, I guess one would be, what can a patient do to advocate for themselves under these conditions? I mean, we talked all day about the physicians, but what about the patient? What can the patient do?
Well, I think it's always wise for a patient to be informed. They're the one responsible. Obviously, it goes without saying for their healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to be informed about that. So if you are questioning something, it's always wise to get a second opinion from another physician. I think it helps when you have a loved one or a family member or a friend in the hospital. Someone has to be that patient's advocate. So
Absolutely.
Someone has to be come alongside them and kind of be responsible to listen to what physicians are telling him in the hospital. It becomes a very confusing time. But so patients need advocate, and the best advocate is a strong friend or a family member. I think they need to be aware of the health plans they're signing up for. Are the restrictions? What are the financial responsibilities? Is my plan going to cover 70% or 80%? What is my copay? And there are certainly plenty of health insurance brokers in town who can help patients with that.
Oh,
so those are a few of the things.
Sure. I'm a big believer in insurance brokers, having done some research on this. These brokers are working essentially for free, trying to help people get health insurance because they, like physicians, have a passion for trying to help people. They're not going to get compensated for the hundreds of hours they're spending with people trying to get them insured, trying to explain what these policies are, trying to explain to them the issues about pre-existing conditions and those who smoke and drink and are obese and what have you. And so you got to go out and start advocating. And we've talked about that with the billing process also. I've had an expert here talking about that. You got to start advocating for your own billing because they're not necessarily going to be correct. But that's not to say that you're going to be able to negate the charges on your bill. It may go up if you challenge it. It could go either way. I don't know how much time people want to invest in their own health insurance and their own health care, but they're going to have to spend more.
Yeah, and with regards to billing, you've seen some of those statements. They're complex. It's hard enough for me to understand some of those things. Now take an 80-year-old person who maybe doesn't have help at home or someone looking or helping them. That's why you need that. But they are very complex, some of those statements.
Well, when we had our expert on, I forgot the percentage, Richard might recall. I think it was 24 or 28%, somewhere in there, of all hospital bills have errors in them right off the top. But of that, a good number of the errors benefit the hospital or do not benefit the patient. And when they're re-audited, the patient ends up owning more. So one must use caution in whether or not they want to challenge the bill. Well, you can see how that happens. Things get hectic. Things are going around. Nurses don't have time to record. People forget. They lose interest. The administrative billing people in the back office are constantly hounding staff to make sure they're doing inventory correctly and whatever. And so I can understand that side of the issue too. That's why it gets so complex. The article again, A Doctor's Declaration of Independence, available at the Wall Street Journal website on April 28th is the date on that. Doctor, thank you for taking time to be out with us. I appreciate very much taking the day off for us.
Thank you for having me here.
With that, we're at the end of the show. Ted Adams back in a couple of weeks on Community Alert, Not If But When, positive preparation for disaster. The news is next on KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio, live at newspress.com. See you next week.
Community Alert. is produced by the Wildland Residents Association San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, with funding provided by a grant from the Cooperative Fire Program of the U.S. Forest Service, Department of Agriculture, Pacific Southwest Region, through the California Fire Safe Council, with additional funding provided by the Fire Services Training Institute. The views and conclusions contained in this program are those of the hosts and guests and should not be interpreted as representing the opinions or policies of the California Fire Safe Council, U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. government, or this station. Any mention of trade names or commercial products does not constitute their endorsement by the California Fire Safe Council or the U.S. government. Commercial use or rebroadcast is prohibited. For further information, call 805-964-7194 or visit wildlandresidents.org. Technical assistance provided by Richard Dugan, Jim Williams, and Mark A. Ward. The WRA and this station are equal opportunity providers.